This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The General Assembly isn't yet in session, but there are still a lot of activity in Indianapolis. A lot of it lately has been with the Indiana Gaming Commission with their regular meetings. And to find out how the Gaming Commission has been doing and the impact of Indiana's gaming industry, that's where we call on Ed Feigenbaum. He's the creator and editor of the Indiana Gaming Insight newsletter for the Hanna News Service. And Ed, thank you for joining us from Indianapolis today.
Well, thank you, Chris, and happy holidays to you and all the Lakeshore Public Radio listeners.
Well, thank you very much. Well, I had, I guess, a pretty busy meeting lately to deal with issues, and I'm sure some of them had to do with some of the latest data that came in on how the revenue figures are showing up for the casinos. Bring us up to date first on financially how the casinos have been doing lately.
Well, again, it's a tale of two cities, tale of two states, tale of two different economies. You know, we had a relatively decent October, but in comparison, not as good as we would have done without, obviously, the pandemic. But still, you know, you can't really complain about $166.6 million in win, and it could have been worse. But we've now seen, you know, four straight months where the year-over-year numbers are lower than the prior year. And that's of concern. You know, we have not seen an increase in year-over-year numbers since the pandemic started, and that was, you know, back with the February numbers. And we'd like to get them back up there, but it's going to be a real heavy lift under the current health and economic conditions, and then to a certain extent, the restrictions that are imposed both by the state and by, in your case, the Lake County Public Health Department and the Gary and East Chicago Public Health Department.
I guess they've all stepped in, and as you say, they've taken some extra measures beyond what the governor had set up with his restrictions in the past. Are we finding that with the changes that the casinos had to make, and we've talked about this before, ahead of being able to be reopened, after the shutdown, are there still just more issues that the local health departments have asked the casinos to go through?
Well, in counties that are orange and red, the local health departments have a little bit more leeway, and those categories are determined by, you know, things like the positivity rate and the number of days that number of cases are at a certain place and hospitalization rates and things like that. And there's kind of a formula, and then once you're there until you can be out of that particular range for 2 weeks. So even if you move some of the metrics, you don't move out of that category immediately. Now, the good news from that, if there is any, is that the capacity limits that would be imposed by local health departments under the more restrictive conditions really aren't going to mean a whole lot to the casinos right now anyway, because none of them are operating under any kind of conditions approaching capacity limits. So by changing things, you're not really hurting them. Yes, if it gets to be too low on Friday and Saturday nights, for example, then it might become an issue. But at least at this point, the casinos are operating nowhere near the cap limits and have not been since, you know, the first couple of days back in business in June. And as a result, it's not all that important. But, you know, there's a psychological barrier there too, Chris. And people are a little bit concerned about being out in public when you're in an orange or a red county. They don't want to necessarily be around a large number of people. And because of the unique way that the casinos are allowed to operate, you know, you're allowed to have more people in a casino than you might in a typical restaurant environment. So you're going to be around more people, masked or unmasked. So, you know, there's a psychological issue there that may be affecting driving consumer behavior as well. I think something that is tangible about this that we've seen is that sports wagering continues to increase while we're not seeing any type of particular gains in casino wagering. You know, people can do the sports wagering from the comfort of their own living room couch, and we're seeing, you know, $230 million in handle for the Indiana sports books back in October. And, you know, that's pretty strong. I mean, that's a record for the Indiana books. You know, Indiana's you know, one of the top six or seven states in the country. Now we're dropping a little bit relatively as other states come online, like Illinois and Colorado, but that's still strong, and it is increasing even as, you know, our neighboring state has grown its sports wagering business. So, you know, the fact that people are willing to wager as seen through the sports wagering. If you look at the first quarter of the new fiscal year, the July through September numbers for the Hoosier Lottery, you'll also see that lottery revenues are up by about 25%, and that's all driven by the instant tickets and not by the draw games. You know, it wasn't until this weekend that the draw games went up over $200 million each for the first time in more than a year.
That's interesting. It had been for a while that they were pretty much equal, weren't they? I mean, there were a lot of people that were buying tickets at the supermarket or the convenience store or the gas station and trying to get their tickets in the hopes of winning the big jackpot, to be sure. And it's interesting that it's changing around a bit. I know that the Indiana Gaming Commission has, of course, had to address the issue that has come up here recently involving this investigation into some allegations of misdeeds by some individuals that are associated, I suppose, with Spectacle Entertainment or Centaur Gaming, I guess either organization. And I guess it's come to a point now that there may be, I guess there's been in some quarters mentioned that there may be some kind of impact that's on the casino that's being built in Gary. Is that still the case? And if you will, bring us up to date on what this is all about and how the Indiana Gaming Commission is going to have to deal with it.
Oh, Chris, you ruined a perfectly good conversation here today.
Well, I'm sorry to do that.
Yeah, this was the big feature of last Monday's Indiana Gaming Commission meeting, and the executive director brought the commissioners up to date on the status of the investigation. And what came out publicly was that more than 10 individuals that are associated with the current Spectacle Entertainment LLC, which is the parent company of Majestic Star Casino and the entity that's building the Gary land-based casino off Burr Street and I-94 with Hard Rock Entertainment, and individuals that had been associated with the former Centaur Gaming, the company that had owned the racinos in Anderson and Shelbyville, were implicated in all sorts of different illicit ventures, shall we say. We're not quite sure exactly what has happened, but there were questions raised in the investigation apparently about the lack of proper disclosures to the commission and other entities, about transfers of ownership interest that had not been cleared with the regulatory authorities, all kinds of different things, as well as things that did not rise to the potential nature of jeopardizing a license or criminal activity. But the other things apparently were pretty serious. And in an Access to Public Records Act request that my publication, Indiana Gaming Insight, made to the Indiana Gaming Commission, we found that at least one individual associated with the group had refused to take an interview with the Indiana Gaming Commission as requested, because this individual's attorney said that the person wished to reserve their Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination. There were three individuals that refused to be interviewed by the Gaming Commission. One of them was the former head of Centaur Gaming, former head of Spectacle Entertainment. But the good news is that the top official at Spectacle, Janae Erpenbach, who's in charge of Majestic Star Casino right now, was I don't want to say cleared, because it's more than clear. She was not implicated in any of this. And she has been working with the commission to provide the commission with everything that the commission's asked. And working with her in this, and somebody who also has not been implicated, is one of the larger shareholders in the Spectacle Venture, and it's a guy from Terre Haute by the name of Greg Gibson. And he is also the individual in charge of the separate Spectacle Jack entity that's building the Terre Haute Hard Rock Casino, Terre Haute, mm-hmm. With Hard Rock International. So you've got two high-level individuals that are not part of the investigation, that you know are still kind of paving the way for the Gary and Terre Haute projects to continue, but there is, you know, serious doubt, as commission staff indicated, that the Spectacle license will be allowed to continue in its current form with its current owners. So we're waiting to hear, and the Gaming Commission members wanted this thing brought to a fore pretty quick. And when the staff was talking about, well, you know, we may need another month, 6 weeks, whatever, the commissioners, you know, kind of rose up and said, no, let's get this thing done in 2 weeks to a max of 4 weeks. And they're looking at perhaps a little bit over 2 weeks time, and then, which leaves only about another week, and then having a special meeting of the Gaming Commission to decide what to do going forward. This is as serious as the commission has ever been with a potential with a licensee, and it does not bode well for a number of individuals that are involved in the project. And I think that you will also see some aspersions cast over the legislative process, because I think that when you find out what's in that report, you're going to see a lot of attention paid to how the 2019 legislation that brought us land-based gaming and sports wagering managed to make it through, particularly without serious objections from some of the entities that one would have thought stood to be hurt the most by a land-based casino in Gary. And I think you're also going to see that at least three former legislators are going to be very, very prominently named, and their reputations will be further sullied by the report.
Is there any possibility, at least as we know right now, until the commission makes a decision of what kind of disposition it's going to have for the Gary Casino that's under construction right now?
Well, I think that if you look at the litany of Gaming Commission actions over the past 25 years, and it literally is 25 years next week that we will have had the first casino in the water, Casino Astar Evansville, back in December of 1995. But if you look at how the Gaming Commission has acted and reacted to situations over the past generation, one thing that they've made clear is that they do not want the actions of an individual, a few individuals, a company, whatever, to necessarily disrupt the best laid plans of a host community. And typically, you know, the host community has not had a part in any of the issues that the Gaming Commission has had to deal with over the years. And what they want to do is make sure that the communities are made whole. And, you know, if a license were to be revoked, which is, you know, about as serious as, well, is as serious as you could get, and has never formally really been done. There was a problem in Evansville with one of the owners, and the owner essentially gave up the license before the final license approval process because he saw the handwriting on the wall after New Jersey yanked his license. But the Gaming Commission will work with what's called a trustee in waiting to make sure that the current operation continues and continues on the correct course, and then we'll work to make sure that the community's license continues going forward, perhaps with a different owner, but working to make sure that a good owner is found, or that an appropriate remedy is put in place in order to continue things with perhaps a couple of different people at the same company. Mm-hmm. But that's what happened in Evansville when they put the trustee in waiting over there, and they decided that, you know, we can't deal with this current company, and, you know, let's take the time with this guy who seems to be running the casino okay on behalf of the people of Evansville and the state of Indiana, and we'll find the right buyer for that property. And they did. And coincidentally, the trustee in waiting for the Gary casinos is the same guy who handled things in Evansville. And it's a Gary native, a guy by the name of Tom Dingman. And Mr. Dingman also has the advantage of having served as general manager for the Indiana Grand property for Centaur Gaming back about a decade or so ago, more than a decade ago. So he's familiar with the individuals. He's familiar with, you know, the market. He's familiar with Indiana gaming and Indiana gaming law, and he will make sure if a trustee in waiting is put in place, he will do the best job possible. And the commission could not be in a better situation with respect to, you know, having a good trustee in waiting than they have there now. And oddly enough, you know, again, the trustee in waiting is chosen by the gaming operator with the approval of the gaming commission, and it's chosen at the time of licensing or license renewal, so that there's not an issue of, oh, okay, well, you know, we know we're going to get dinged, so, you know, let's put in somebody who's going to work with us on the side, you know, those kinds of shady deals. So this thing is going to work one way or another.
Well, it sounds like it. We'll just have to wait to see actually what the Indiana Gaming Commission does here in a few weeks. It sounds like it's going to be a lot sooner than what some folks had asked for. But that's good news, because we'll know faster as the disposition of this. We'll have to talk again to get some thoughts about what happens at that point. Thank you for being with us today and bringing us up to date and kind of assuring us here in Northwest Indiana that despite all these individual problems and allegations that the plans for the new casino to replace the Riverboat Casinos in Gary is not going to go asunder, at least not right now anymore.
Yeah, it'll be a Merry Christmas for criminal defense attorneys.
That's for sure, to be sure. Well, thank you, Ed, for being with us today. We really do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
You're welcome. Ed Feigenbaum is the creator and editor of the Indiana Gaming Insight newsletters based with Hannah News Service. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Porter County Substance Abuse Council is addressing the unintended consequences of substance abuse disorder, and they also are trying to forge some community partnerships to help reduce what are called recidivism rates. That's all, of course, related to drug-related crimes, and there have been some good programs that have been underway in Porter County. Let's find more about them and the rest of the work of the Substance Abuse Council. We have with us on the phone from Porter County, we have Chuck Harris. He's the president of the board of the council, as well as Dawn Pelk. She is the executive director of the Porter County Substance Abuse Council. And Dawn and Chuck, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you.
Well, Dawn, I'll let you speak. Give us an idea of for folks that are not familiar with the council, what the Porter County Substance Abuse Council is all about.
Well, the Porter County Substance Abuse Council is the hub in the county of Porter, and we address prevention, treatment, and recovery issues with substance use disorder. And we have different programs and strategies throughout the county. And so basically, we just get people, groups, providers, agencies in the county to get together in order to do some of these activities that need to be done.
When you get the information in that comes in from the agencies, and we're talking not only about nonprofits, governmental agencies, even law enforcement, do you have to sort through it, I guess, first to be able to determine, first off, if it's something that the council can deal with, or do you have an opportunity just by your general, general action, to be able to take a look at these and try to help the organizations try to resolve this?
Well, we have an epidemiologist on staff that is able to go through all the data that we collect, and we compile the comprehensive community plan, which will let us know what is trending in the community. So we address those points. Right now we have underage drinking, heroin, opioids, and marijuana are our top three priorities. But then if there's something else that we notice within the community that needs attention, we will use our resources to address those problems so we can get a quick turnaround before things get out of hand.
Now, Dawn, I know that you had attended a national criminal conference a National Criminal Justice Conference last fall, and you came away from that conference with some very interesting information. And how did that in turn help you and your board direct the work that you're doing now?
Well, I was sent to the conference, and it was basically criminology, the causes and consequences and all that, which I don't really have a extensive background in that. So some of it was over my head. But as I was listening to all these presentations, the takeaway that I got that all these people, the speakers on all these panels, were at one time incarcerated. And then they told the story about how they went from incarceration through education, and then they were able to be self-sustaining and increase their quality of life. So it just, that was like my main takeaway. So I had the idea on the way home to talk to Chuck and the board to see if we could work with other community providers to do something about that to reduce the recidivism.
Now, Chuck, if you will, tell us, since you represent the board, being the president of the board and your colleagues on the board, how did you take the information that Dawn had brought back to you and brought to the board? How did you take it, and what did you feel that you could do as a board to be able to bring providers together, set up these partnerships to help deal with the problems?
Right. Well, we appreciate everything that Dawn does for our organization, first of all, because she goes above and beyond for our organization. But when she brought that information back, we do have a coalition that we sit down and we have monthly meetings with them. And when we told them about this idea, just kind of spitballing the idea out there for everybody to hear, everybody realized that the recidivism rates are very high. And to try to break those, the programs that Dawn had heard about seemed like a very viable option. So we approached the coalition about those programs, and just like Porter County always does, is everybody was all on board. They were very eager to get something started, and we had a lot of organizations like the Respite House, Recovery Connection, Ivy Tech, IUN, the Sheriff's Department, Center of Workforce Innovations. It was really amazing how the whole community got together and wanted to all jump on board with this idea. So it was a very collective effort on all those organizations that I just mentioned to you, and a few others as well.
Chuck, if you will, tell us about some of these organizations that are part of the coalition here. For example, like the Recovery Connection, how do they fit into the picture of trying to deal with and make sure that the people who are treated for substance abuse maybe have gone to jail and have served some time, but to try to keep them from going back into jail?
Right. Well, Recovery Connection will try to get people treatment. They also try to help people with different aspects of the recovery process as well. And Recovery Connection was definitely one of those organizations that they were one of the main people at the table trying to get this program started. And they are going to be a very vital part of this process to get people that are seeking help to us, and we can get them into these types of programs.
Now, Dawn, can you tell us a little bit about the work that you're able to do in connection with leading the board and working with the Recovery Connection?
Well, sure. Recovery Connection has really taken the lead in this project. They're actually known as the hub of Porter County as far as recovery initiatives go. And so their coordinator, Christy Shervinek, she has worked with me as well as the other people on this committee she can provide the space. So if there's anybody out there listening that either knows somebody that needs a GED, formerly known as, it's now called an HSE, a high school equivalency, mm-hmm. We're going to, her place is going to be the addendum site. So they will be able to actually take the classes And then there's support from IUN and Ivy Tech life coaches are going to be there to help so nobody gets discouraged. And then when they get to the point where they need to take their test, that site is also a proctor site, an addendum site through Work One. So there is a program like this in the jail, but then also if people are in recovery or anybody that's a Porter County resident that would like to fulfill their goal of getting their diploma, they're able to do so at the Recovery Connection location. And then from there on, we're thinking that we are going to be filtering people to college if that's what they want to do at Ivy Tech, as well as we could provide additional credentialing. There's some apprenticeship opportunities available, and there's credentialing for OSHA 10 to assist with, application and all that to get into an apprenticeship. So there's different opportunities once you get the diploma. And then also at this point, we're working with the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana, like as an incentive, if you are continuing this program and you're hitting all your benchmarks, As far as getting your credentials, the HSD, then we will provide like a food box scholarship that we're calling it through the food bank. So as you can see, like there's all these different people involved and all these different agencies to try to help someone get the GED, because it's not really as easy as it sounds. There's all these obstacles people have to overcome. So we are here to help.
Now, Chuck, if you'll tell us a little bit more about the Respite House and Mitch Peters, who's the founder of the Recovery Home, how does he fit into all of this and helping deal with the issue of recidivism and trying to keep people who have gone to jail and served time because of drug-related crimes to help keep them out? What is his role in fitting in all this and working with the overall work, I suppose, of the Porter County Substance Abuse Council?
Well, Mitch is a great leader here in our community, and he is one of the people that started Respite House, and he's actually in the process of completing the second Respite House right now here in Porter County.
Mm-hmm.
So he's down on the front lines. He is one of the people that probably works with substance abuse people more than anybody in our community. Housing people, men that are trying to get help in our community. They try to keep them there at the facility. They go out for work. And one of the problems that people have that have had substance abuse problems is just the education. They don't have the education to get the jobs. And if you don't have that education, people seem to fall back in the same problems that they've had previously. So his main goal is just to help his clients get a little bit of education, and then possibly once they get that HSE, or the formerly known as the GED, once they get that, then possibly move over to like a certification in different professions, and maybe a possible apprenticeship in the building trades. To help people, once they have that security of a job and an income, it helps with other aspects of their lives as well.
Now, Don, if you will, tell us the works that has already been underway and I'm sure continuing on inside the Porter County Jail. They've been working very hard to help try to keep the number of people from coming back into the jail because of many drug-related crimes and because of maybe the overall substance abuse disorder that they face.
Right. Well, we have a good relationship, working relationship with the sheriff, Sheriff Reynolds, as well as the chaplain there, Jay Berkey, and they have a chemical dependence and addiction program as well as a therapeutic community, and they also have a space, the God Pod, where they do different things as far as education and things like that. Talking to Jay, he said their program alone with just the chemical dependence and addiction program has reduced recidivism by 45%. So they're doing a great job, and we just wanted to partner with them to, you know, help them once the people, the incarcerated, get out of jail, just, you know what I mean, like a continuum of care. So that way, all of a sudden, they're out of jail and they don't know where else to go. Then we have them move to Recovery Connection, where there's all kinds of additional programs, like they have the AA programs, NA, Smart Recovery, and all that. So the Porter County Substance Abuse Council just in essence acts as a coordinator. So we coordinate all these different agencies together, and we're just trying to give hope to the community and move everything forward. That's what we're here for.
Now, Chuck and Dawn, can you give us phone numbers or contact numbers where if anybody has concerns in Porter County, they know of family members or others that need help, where can they get it? And if they need to reach you folks at the Substance Abuse Council, how they can do so?
Well, the Porter County Substance Abuse Council's phone number, if you need some kind of a referral, if you have a loved one or know somebody that has substance abuse issues, the number here is 219-462-0946, 462-0946. And then also, if anybody listening has somebody that they know or even themselves that need to complete their GED, their slash HSE, mm-hmm. We have openings right now. And the number you can call, that's Christy at Recovery Connection. Her number is 219-510-6319. If you, again, need the GED, it's 219-510-6319.
Dawn Pelk is Executive Director of the Porter County Substance Abuse Council, and Chuck Harris is the President of the Board of the Substance Abuse Council. And thank you both very much for being with us to talk about the subject, and we're glad to hear some good news and pass along to everybody here on the program today.
Thanks for the opportunity, Chris.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. Back with you tomorrow.